Once a month, we head underground for a perusal of the vast wealth of historical treasures under our feet. Our regular guides are the people of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Archaeologist Mark Tveskov from SULA is back with us today. Good to have you back, Mark.
It's good to be back, as always.
And this month, he's brought in a couple of guests who investigated, and non-invasively, we point out, Native American burial mounds in the upper Midwest. Their research shows an ongoing relationship between the mounds and lightning strikes. Let's meet the archaeologist Sigurd Arnault with Sigurd Arnault Consulting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello.
And David Mackey is with us as well from Archaeophysics, is the name of his company. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you.
So can one of you, either Sigurd or David, give us a sketch of this Buffalo Slough Mound group that you investigated?
This mound group is on Prairie Island, which is a large island. It's about 3 miles long, about a mile wide, in the Mississippi River Valley Basin. So it's a really low kind of a sandbar that historically had no trees on it. But it's part of this Red Wing locality where there's a lot of prehistoric activity. And at the turn of the century, there are 360 burial mounds on this small island. And so we know that there was a really large human population here. A lot of foodstuffs, both from the Mississippi River on one side and the Vermilion River on the other.
Wow, 360 mounds, that's a big number that it did exist, and about how many are left now?
Probably about 100.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is one of the first places that settlers came because there were no trees, it was easy to plow, and so almost all of them have been heavily impacted by plowing.
Okay, before we get too deep into the destruction, David Mackey, can you tell us about how the mounds were generally created?
Well, that's one of the goals of our research. It appears they borrowed soil from the surrounding areas and would build a primary burial chamber where probably an important family or individual was buried in sort of a chamber, not unlike you'd find in a tomb in Greece or Egypt or something. And then a bunch of soil was borrowed from the surrounding area and piled on top.
So essentially, just as more grave, I mean, it sounds almost like a vertical cemetery in a sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then people would come back through the generations, over the course of perhaps hundreds of years, and continue to bury their relatives in the built up portion of the mound.
So potentially, many people are buried in these mounds.
Oftentimes, dozens, possibly even hundreds.
And first, I want to ask Mark Tveskov about burial practices that you work with in your work largely in Oregon. If there's anything like this that compares among the Native tribes here,
Not the great earthworks particularly in Southern Oregon and Western Oregon. Here, indigenous people made formal cemeteries, much like the settlers did, adjacent to their villages.
Sigurd Arnault, I understand there was a pipeline that was planned, recently rerouted, rather than go through this area. But as you mentioned, the mounds have been disturbed, and generally by agriculture and road building?
Yes. In fact, as the earliest map of this mound was actually done in 1884 by a man named T.H. Lewis, who was trying to map all the mounds in Minnesota. At that point, he notes that one mound had been disturbed for road building. So they often use mounds actually as fill material. And since this is in a floodplain, it appears that they mined the mounds partially to build up the roadway.
Any idea of whether they were finding human remains, and if so, what happened to those?
Yes, they probably were finding human remains. They usually just throw that away. They also found burial goods, and in one of these mounds that was in the roadway, they found a small copper axe, in fact. So there were some burial goods also that were with the burials.
So this is the Madewakanton Dakota is the tribe that inhabited that area, is that right?
Historically, the Madewakanton.
Okay, pronounced it wrong.
Band of the Dakota. So the Dakota are the eastern Dakota that lived along the Mississippi River and the Minnesota River valleys.
And it sounds like in their burial traditions, you did bury people with some of the goods that represent their lives or that were important to them?
Sometimes the offerings are things that have probably been lost, like animal remains or food. Some burials really don't have anything with them, sometimes just some personal items. So it's a huge variety. This is a tradition that started around 500 BC in this area, it was reached its fluorescence around 1000 BC. So it's just a huge amount of variety in what we see people doing with burials through time, even within the burial mound tradition.
Mm-hmm. And Sigrid, could you speak? So there was road construction that disturbed the burial mounds a long time ago, and then now there's a recent pipeline, which I imagine is the project you were involved with. Could you speak to the way that indigenous communities were able to or not able to participate in consultation back then, as opposed to how they were involved with the project you were involved with?
Sure. So because of the U.S.-Dakota War in 1862, all the treaties with the Dakota people were abrogated, and they were exiled from Minnesota. In fact, there was a bounty on Dakota people. They could be killed just on site. So after that happened, there were Dakota who lived under the protection sometimes of white people, but they were not able to have any say in what happened to their burial grounds. So in the 19th century, people started coming back secretly to Prairie Island, and by the 1930s, there was a community there that was recognized. So when we did the work in 2012, we were actually working, this natural gas pipeline was for the tribe, and so that their tribal historic preservation officer and tribal members were part of the consultation of how to route this this gas pipeline.
And so it did eventually go around it?
Yes, it did.
Okay. We're talking to some archaeologists as part of our monthly Underground History segment. Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology joins me in the studio. Sigrid Arno and David Mackey are both people who worked on the burial mounds in Buffalo Slough Mound Group in Minnesota. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. David Mackey, so the mounds apparently not visible to the naked eye. What obscures the view?
Mostly 100 years or more of plowing have kind of flattened the mounds, so they're not readily apparent to the naked eye generally. A few of them are, but many of them, you can stand on the site and not be able to perceive it. But we've used some non-invasive methods that allow us to see it, most notably LIDAR or aerial laser scanning. Allows us to make a digital elevation model and use various imaging techniques to see what's on the ground. And then once we see it in the LIDAR data, we can walk out to the site and then perceive it.
So the LIDAR makes what is subtle in person fairly stark on a map, it looks like.
Right. Once you know what you're looking for and you know where it is, then it's possible to see it under the right lighting conditions. But you'd never notice it if you were just walking across this field.
So before they were disturbed, I mean, how tall were any of these mounds? I mean, I guess people shouldn't walk around thinking they look like anthills or something. I mean, they were not gigantic things compared to the land around them.
Well, you know, some of them are 10 feet tall or more, or were. Generally, they weren't that high, though. In the 1880s, when Theodore Lewis mapped them, they varied in height from anywhere from a foot to, I don't know, 8 feet or so.
So, Sigrid, once you found the mounds through the LIDAR, and again, this is non-invasive. This is it involves an airplane, I think. But once you found them, what was the thrust of your research on the ground?
Well, we wanted to figure out what their integrity was below ground, and we also wanted to figure out if there were features associated with the mounds around them, because when we were thinking about, at one point, they were thinking about trying to reroute this pipeline between mounds. And we were concerned that there could be mortuary features that didn't have a topographic expression that were below ground.
When you say mortuary features, what kind of things do you mean?
Well, we know that the Dakota almost always, sometimes they use these primary burials that Dave was talking about in the chambers, but often then there were secondary burials. So they would have a sky burial on a scaffold. And then they would collect the bones and rebury them. So we know that there were scaffolds. And then sometimes we find that there are just burials outside of the mounds. And there were probably cremations, all kinds of things taking place in this larger mortuary landscape.
Were the people who were buried in the mounds of greater status than people who were not? Was there any sort of division in cultural or socioeconomic status based on where you were in relation to a mound?
Probably not. It appears that they're more like a family group. And we'll see that children might have the same type of burial that an adult would have, sometimes the same kind of grave goods. So perhaps some families were higher status, but it doesn't appear that mounds were only reserved for high-status individuals.
So once you were at the mound sites, and again with the LIDAR, you could figure out exactly where they were and approximately how big they were. I mean, what did you do on the ground then?
So then Dave can talk about some of the different techniques we did, but we didn't know exactly what the results would be. So the first thing we did was we found two known mounds side by side, and we tested three different methods on them. And then we chose the best method to survey a larger area.
So Dave, why don't you walk us through those methods?
Well, we tested three different non-invasive subsurface geophysical methods. Electrical resistance was one of them. Magnetic survey was another, and ground penetrating radar was the third.
And which appeared to be the most? I mean, first of all, what were you looking to detect with any of these, and which one was the most effective?
Well, we were attempting to map the mounds and associated mortuary landscape. In this particular case, ground penetrating radar was the most successful, and we'd hoped magnetic survey would work the best, but that turned out not to be the case.
And this is really one of the more interesting points of the story. So there were things going on magnetically with the mounds themselves. Is that right?
Right. We did the survey, and there was high amplitude signal coming from the mounds that form patterning. And we've seen this sort of signal before caused by lightning strikes. It's not entirely uncommon on archaeology sites in general, but I'd never seen this many or this dense of a concentration of lightning signal on a site before. So it was kind of annoying at the time because it was obscuring the signal we were looking for, which was the more subtle signal coming from the mounds themselves and surrounding features. In this high-amplitude lightning signal kind of cluttered everything else out, so didn't allow us to see anything that we were actually looking for.
So lightning had struck the mounds over and over again, it sounds like?
It looks like probably the landscape itself had been struck by lightning through geologic time, and perhaps for this reason the natives decided to build burial mounds there. And the factor, the mounding of soil increased the probability of lightning strikes at this particular spot.
Mark Tveskov.
And so what did the Dakota think of those observations that you made?
I would guess they seem to not be too surprised. That's my perception.
All right, the article that Dave Mackey and Sigrid Arno wrote with Mike Bergervoet from the Minnesota Department of Transportation is called Lightning-Induced Remnant Magnetization at the Buffalo Slough Burial Mound Complex, Buffalo Slough along the Mississippi River in Minnesota. This is part of our monthly underground history segment with Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come back to that term, lightning-induced remnant magnetization. Means what, David?
Well, if you pass a current through a conductor, you will create an electromagnetic field that's kind of concentric around the current. And in the case of lightning, it's a huge current, so it's a really strong electromagnetic field that surrounds the current pathway. And the magnetic component of that signal can remagnetize the iron in the soil. So what you end up with is a map of the current pathway through the soil based on the remagnetized iron in the soil.
So you're essentially showing the pathway that the lightning took through the soil? Is that what you mean by pathway?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you can see kind of linear expression of the lightning pathway. In some cases, it branches out and looks kind of like a tree roots or something.
Let's come back then to Dakota traditions. And Sigrid, I wonder if you have some knowledge to share with us about what Dakota tradition says about lightning and what it means.
Well, almost all Native religions recognize the Thunderbird deities. And in the Dakota tradition, the Thunderbird is important for a lot of earth renewal rituals. And in particular, at this story site, there's a ethnic or oral history saying that in the spring, people would come back, watch, and welcome the lightning back. And the thunder god also was seen as a supernatural being that could broker relationships between the sky, the upper world, and the lower world. So we also see perhaps that the upper world is where the spirits would go after death, and perhaps there was an idea that the lightning was making this connection between death and the afterlife. I'm not really a Dakota religion expert, but there's a long tradition of a lot of rituals related to lightning. And another thing that we uncovered was that a lot of there's evidence that a lot of these mounds had poles in them, and that those poles had something to do with rituals.
Encouraging lightning to strike there?
Perhaps. We don't really know.
We don't know if it was on purpose, but it seems pretty clear that it was attracting lightning strikes.
Okay, Mark Treskov?
Yeah, and speaking of long traditions, I mean, when I read this article, I was really struck by the fact of what a rich story you were able to tell without putting a shovel into the ground and while allowing the remnants of these burial mounds to be preserved. And I was thinking about the long tradition of mound archaeology and North American archaeology, and how when I teach intro to archaeology classes, I tell the story of how Thomas Jefferson himself dug into one of these burial mounds because he was trying to test this idea that these grand earthworks might not have been made by Native American people. And that was the so-called mystery of the mound builders. But that act itself, and sometimes Thomas Jefferson is described as the father of American archaeology, but he was also the first grave robber in that sense. So I wonder if you guys, in the detail of this project, have reflected back on where archaeology has gone from that point to this point.
That's the same tradition of archaeology that took place in Minnesota, too. As soon as I think the first archaeological excavation in Minnesota was 1856, and the treaties were signed with the Dakota people in 1851. So even at that point, the Dakota people had only been gone for 5 years, and they started talking about these couldn't have been created by the Dakota. It must have been mound builders, kind of disassociating these incredible earthworks from the people that they had driven out.
Because they made the assumption that they were not advanced enough to make those sorts of things?
Yes, yes. And the idea was that only an advanced civilization could have created these perfectly round tumuli, and some of them are effigies in the forms of panthers and birds, and they just didn't think that the savages could have done this, so that they thought that there was an earlier race of people, perhaps from Atlantis, who had done it.
Oh, wow.
And that the native peoples had come in and killed this advanced race and driven them out. So that is the tradition that was kind of active here in Minnesota, too. And ironically, it was, T.H. Lewis that we mentioned earlier was sort of believed in the mound builder myth, and he wanted to write a large book about it. And so he went around and he had meticulous surveys of all of these mound groups. So the book was never written. But ironically, it's really helped us preserve these mounds now because a lot of them are so degraded, they're hard to see. But if we can use, say, LIDAR to geo-reference Lewis's maps, we can see where mounds that are now plowed down used to be.
Hmm.
So I think actually the last mound excavation of a mound site in Minnesota was in the 1970s, and I think it was on Prairie Island, and it was stopped by the American Indian Movement.
Hmm. Okay, so
there haven't been any mound excavations for research purposes since the 1970s.
So, David Mackey, I did not ask about the incidence of lightning strikes in surrounding territory. Did you investigate that, too?
On this particular site, we focused on several mounds, but last year we went back and surveyed a different burial mound site, collected a larger area of data, and saw even more lightning strikes, even higher density associated with mounds.
So I guess this gets down to a which came first question. Did the natives build the mounds where lightning had struck, or did lightning strike because the mounds were there?
I think a little bit of both. I think they probably observed nature and the fact that lightning was important to their religion and worldview attracted them to lightning-prone landforms, and then the fact that they build these mounds on lightning-prone landforms and put poles on them attracted even more lightning. So it was a bit of a closed loop.
Okay, a continued cycle, sure. Mm-hmm. And this article that we were referencing here was published in 2015. I assume you've been back to the site since then. Is that a fair assumption, Sigrid?
Yes. We were actually just working on this project for the tribe last summer, and we did remote sensing of several tribes or several mound groups. So we're continuing the research.
Wow, it's really fascinating stuff. And as we pointed out, Mark Tveskov has underlined the fact that this is very non-invasive stuff. We're just talking about things resting on the ground that looks below without actually disturbing any soil at all. Do you do much of this yourself, Mark, in the region?
We hired David Mackey to do it for us. He's worked on some of our Rogue River War projects, and that's where we met, and he's done similar work on the Miners Fort site and other projects for us here.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing David and Sigrid to our attention. David Mackey, Sigrid Arnott, thank you so much for your contributions today to Underground History. And Mark Tveskov, always good to see you. See you next month, we hope.
Yeah, it's great to be here.